The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
We're going to offer all of the party leaders an opportunity to join us here in studio on The Last Word on Today FM before the general election for a detailed interview. And we're starting today with the outgoing Taoiseach, the leader of Fine Gael, Leo Varadkar. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on the programme.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
You're nearly 9 years in government personally. You're Taoiseach for nearly three. How much would you fear that now you've become perceived by the electorate as the establishment, and that often electorates like to decide, well, we want to change that establishment. We want fresh blood, fresh thinking.
I have to say, I've never felt like I'm the establishment, I have to tell you. But I'd put it this way, you know, I'm Taoiseach now for just over 2 years, and in those 2 years, we've got a lot of really good things started. Project Ireland 2040, our infrastructure plan, the climate action plan, implementation of Sláinte Care, the biggest reform of policing really since the foundation of the state. All those things have really only started in the past 2 years or so.
Is that
since
all you
I
want people
Taoiseach
to look to, those 2 years plus that you've been Taoiseach rather than the 9 years when it gets?
I'm happy to come to that, but what I'd really hate to see is those big plans, those transformational reforms that we've started on being jeopardised in any way. Why didn't we start them earlier? You know why we didn't start them earlier, because the first job that we had to do when we got into government back in 2011 was to get people back to work, to get the economy functioning again, to restore our sovereignty internationally and our reputation around the world, get the Troika out. And of course, in more recent years, we've had to really focus on Brexit, on making sure that we avoided a no-deal Brexit and a hard border and all of that. So, you know, government has been busy for the past number of years when I've been involved in it, but there's so much good stuff, so many really transformational plans that we've just got started in the past 2 years.
Well, hang on,
and the reason why I'm looking
problems?
For a full 5 years so I can follow through on those and get them done.
Yeah, but isn't that one of your problems that perhaps we'll say after 9 years in power, notwithstanding all of the difficulties you inherited, that you're talking about plans for the future rather than actually having a significant body of achievement to be able to defend?
Well, I think we do. You know, we've gone from a situation whereby we had mass unemployment and forced emigration to a situation whereby the reverse is the case. There's a job for almost everyone who wants one. And we have more people coming into the country than leaving it, returning to the country. We have incomes rising, poverty rates now falling 5 years in a row, child poverty falling too. Our reputation around the world as a country is restored. We've secured the withdrawal agreement on Brexit. We've really started to do some really exciting things that I would see around work-life balance and families. You know, things like paternity benefit brought in, parental leave just kicking in, the national childcare scheme, all those things that we're really about as a party, which is allowing people to spend more time with their family, more time with their kids, and also making work-life balance better and more flexible. And then really exciting infrastructure plans. You know, we couldn't afford to invest in infrastructure for years, and now looking out behind the back of your head, seeing cranes, and there are cranes now cropping up all over the city.
Those buildings that you're referring to are student apartment blocks. There seems to be no problem getting those up quickly, but there's a massive problem getting social housing built and getting a sufficient number of private houses and apartments built as well. Because you have a slogan for your party, a future to look forward to. For many people, particularly people under the age of 40, the future that they're looking forward to is, as they see it, never having the opportunity to own their own home like previous generations had, and paying massively excessive rents, which leave them financially stretched at the end of each month. So yes, they're happy to have a job, but they actually don't see a particularly bright future to look forward to.
Yeah, and that's something that we're going to have to change. And, you know, I'm a big believer in home ownership. You know, a lot of people, particularly on the left, you know, criticise private property and talk about it being a bad thing. I think private property is a good thing. And the mainstay of private property is actually owning your own home. And I still remember the day when I got the deeds to my place, turned the key in the door, still live there, by the way, my apartment, and, you know, sat on my own couch and watched my own TV. And I want that to be
what age
attainable.
Were you when you did that?
I just started off working as a junior doctor, so I must have been about 24, 25. And now
do
it's
know
very
how
different.
How few
yeah.
people
I do.
In their 20s and even 30s, particularly single people, get to actually buy their own house or apartment. That's something that seems to have just gone.
I do, actually. And, you know, I'm very conscious of that because of my age group and because of the fact that I have a lot of friends who are in their 30s. And for us, it was not unusual for somebody in their mid-20s to buy their first place. Now people tend to be in their 30s, and that's something that we need to change.
If they can buy at all, because even the home ownership numbers in their 30s has collapsed. The overall numbers owning are falling, but that's distorted by the fact of older people who continue to own their houses. So what's the future for somebody who isn't ever going to be able to buy their own house and who worries that when it comes to retirement years, for example, they won't be able to afford the rent?
Well, if I have anything to do with it, they will be able to buy their own house. You know, you asked about our record in 2016, which was the year that my party took over the housing brief. Simon Coveney became the housing minister. Alan Kelly had had it before that. There were less than 9,000 new houses and apartments built in this country. Last year was 21,000. So we've more than doubled the supply of new housing.
Which is still behind the target that you had set in the 2016 election manifesto, which was 25,000 a year.
Well, we don't have the figures yet for 2019 yet. But if you include vacant houses brought back into use, student accommodation, all those things, it probably is quite close to 25,000. But what's indisputable is that we've more than doubled the supply of new houses and apartments, excluding student accommodation and all those other things. In the 3 years since 2016, we need to double it again. We need to get from about 20,000 to 40,000, which is where I think we need to be in terms of adequate housing supply. And we are seeing the effect of that new supply already. House prices are levelling off. They're still 20% lower than they were when they peaked under Fianna Fáil. And we're also helping people to buy. Are you familiar with the Help to Buy scheme?
Yes, and the Help to Buy scheme, at the moment, the interest rates in relation to that are going up, aren't they?
That's the Rebuilding Ireland Home Loan.
Rebuilding Ireland.
Yeah, the Help to Buy scheme is something different. It's where essentially you get a tax rebate and you can put that towards your deposit. So that's already helped 16,000 people, brought in by Simon Coveney, already helped 16,000 people to buy their first home. And
it's
we want to enhance
that.
It's a
low number, isn't it, given the overall demand that there actually is out there.
And that's why we want to enhance it. We've tried this scheme. We know it works. It's helped 16,000 individuals and couples already. And we want to enhance that now, make it better so that you can get up to 10% of the value of the property back in terms of rebate, up to 30,000. And that's will help a lot more people to raise a deposit. Because for a lot of people, and, you know, I meet people all the time who are in this kind of rent trap where they may have a decent income, but they're paying rent, paying for childcare, paying a lot of income tax. And as a result of that, they're not able to afford to save, or they can only save a very small amount of money. And this is exactly for them, allowing them to get up to 30,000 euros worth
of
their tax back.
And I want to get back to childcare later.
And that helps them pay for the deposit. Because that's often the problem people have. They can afford the rent, just about, and the mortgage would actually be less than the rent, but they can't get the deposit. And that's, you know, we've seen the scheme works. We're now going to enhance it if we get
the
chance.
But what about the failure to build sufficient number of social houses? And I know you'll tell me that there are 10,000 social houses added to the stock last year. Except more than half of those were actually purchased and refurbished rather than actually built. How much of a failure is there?
That's not correct.
Yes, it is. The numbers actually built are more around 4,000.
No, roughly about 10,000 houses were added to the social housing stock, which is the term that I often use last year. About two-thirds were new builds. I think what you're looking at is the ones that were new builds only by local authorities. That was probably around 4,000. But we also do new builds through partnerships, for example, with the Ivy Trust, that, you know, social housing bodies that have been providing housing for a very long time.
It's still
Clued,
way below what we actually need when it comes to the provision of social housing. Something that this state was able to do many, many decades ago when it had far less money than we have now.
Well, do you know what? Over the past 20 years, you know, in this century, pretty much every party has controlled at some point the Department of Housing. Greens, Fianna Fáil, Labour, Fine Gael. Nobody in this century has provided an extra 10,000 social houses in 1 year other than this government. It'll be 11,000 next year, 12,000 the year after that, and we will provide an extra 60,000 social housing homes over the next 5 years if re-elected. And you can trust us to do it because we're the ones who actually have turned this around in the last couple of years. The vast majority of them will be new builds. They won't all be done by local authorities. It makes sense to work through housing trusts, Ivy Trust, Clwyd, you know, Fold, all those housing associations that do a really good job. And it's all the same when you're a person moving into those, whether it's a council house or a housing association house. And yes, in some cases, there will be purchases. And actually, in a lot of Ireland, particularly rural parts of Ireland, it makes sense for local authorities to CPO a derelict house or buy a house and bring it back into use. It could even be cheaper to do that than to buy a new one from scratch. So it's a mix of measures, and that's how it's done.
Wouldn't a dramatic increase in the construction of social housing allow you to save on an estimated 1 billion a year that's been paid over to landlords landlords in housing, rent supplements and the like?
It would, but you can only ramp these things up so quickly. And that's actually why I get a little bit worried when I hear about the housing solutions from some of the other parties, because they have a very ideological view around this. They believe that the only social housing that counts is social housing provided by local authorities, the very, very traditional way of providing local authorities housing. If we went back to that, I think for the first couple of years, you'd actually see the supply of new social housing fall because the local authorities don't have the capacity to deliver. And they're really only ramping that up slowly over time. And if you start to shut out those approved housing bodies, you know, like the housing trusts, for example, you'll actually see supply fall. And that would be a big mistake, in my view.
Let's move on to health, which is a major issue for so many people, particularly when they see in recent weeks the amount of people on trolleys and emergency departments who can't gain admission to hospitals because there simply aren't the beds there. And one of the reasons maybe the beds aren't there is because we don't have enough nurses and doctors in the hospital system. And yet today you're calling for things like the extension of free GP care to all under 18s by 2025, removing hospital charges for children, free dental care for under 16s, a baby box for every newborn. Instead of these publicity stunts, why don't you actually deal with the actual real issues which are affecting the delivery of existing services?
Well, they are real measures, and they're measures to reduce the cost of living for families, which is one of the things we want to do. We're building on what we've done already, things like the National Childcare Scheme, like 2 years of ECHE preschool for kids, which parents really value, like, for example, free GP care for the under sixes and for carers and for others. So,
but do we have enough doctors to deliver these GP services? Over the last 5 years, we've only had less than 100 extra GPs. There are rural areas all over the country where there are doctors staying on who want to retire, but they can't get anybody to actually replace them. They're full on their lists, and yet they've been told, now let's do more work for free.
Well, it's not for free.
Well, they get paid a fee by the state, but they can only take on so much work without taking on the extra work you want them to do.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, they're doing this work already, except that by making it free, the state would pay for it rather than the parents having to pay for it through fees. But, you know, no GP will be forced to do this. It'll be an opt-in service, and we'll make sure that the fee is attractive for them and they can put those resources behind their practice. But, you know, we do need more doctors. Compared to other Western European countries, the number of doctors we have per head is lower than the average. But one thing you probably may not have heard or perhaps don't know, and it doesn't come across in debates enough, we actually have more doctors and more GPs in Ireland than ever before. You check with the HSC, they'll tell you that they have more GPs who have a contract with the HSC than ever before. If you check with the medical council, they'll tell you that they have more GPs on what they call the GP specialist register than ever before. And we're training more GPs than ever before. And notwithstanding,
we're training GPs who mainly emigrate, don't they?
A lot of them do, but actually less do than did in the past. And there was huge demand to get on the GP scheme. And yes, doctors do emigrate, but also doctors come in as well. And I think often people, that isn't reflected. We've actually never had more doctors on the medical council register than ever before. Yes, some retire. Yes, a lot of emigrate. But the reverse happens too.
People, but you also have a lot of them working on a part-time basis. Because if you look at the latest HSE figures, for example, and this was in the Business Post yesterday, 2015, there were 2,889 GPs held contracts with the state. As of January 2020, the number of agreements with GPs, 2,974. That's an increase over the last 5 years of 85.
And it is an increase, Matt. And I'm glad you put those figures across, because a lot of people listening to you on the radio would have the impression that we have fewer doctors in the country and fewer GPs in the country than we had a few years ago. That's not the case. It is increasing, but yes, so is the population, so is demand for healthcare. And that's one of the reasons why we negotiated a new contract with GPs just in the last couple of months that will put over €200 million into general practice, into their practices, particularly focusing on managing chronic disease so that fewer people end up in hospitals in the first place.
I
mentioned, we want to build on that.
The 760 patients waiting on trolleys and chairs in our emergency departments in January and looking for a bed. You had a bed capacity review published in 2018 and you committed to 2,600 extra hospital beds, 4,500 more community beds in the National Development Plan up to 2027. How many of those since that announcement have already gone into place?
I don't have the exact figure on the top of my head. Certainly since we've come into office, we've put about 600 more beds back into the hospitals, but that would be since about 2012 or 2013. and about 200 are going in this month. Those figures do change, by the way, because beds open and beds close. But the fundamental point, and I totally acknowledge this, is that we don't have enough beds in our hospitals. We do have more beds per head than the UK, by the way, but compared to most European countries, we're very short. And we have, as soon as we could afford to, we've been putting beds back in. You know, we shouldn't forget that Fianna Fáil took 1,400 beds out of our hospitals for reasons they should explain. It wasn't financial, it was done from 2005 onwards. And we've been reversing that. We've got about 600 extra in by the end of last year, about 200 more going in this year. Three hospitals under construction, two that'll open this year, new blocks in Waterford, new blocks in Limerick and Clonmel, all opening this year. But you're right, it isn't enough. And we need to do way more than that. And if we keep the economy strong, if we keep minding the public finances, if we stay in office, we can deliver on that.
Do you really think that the public and the voters care about what Fianna Fáil did when it was last in power, given that it is now 9 years since the voters ejected that Fianna Fáil Green government?
Do you know what? I don't know if they care, but I do know that it matters. You know, just as I have to stand over our record in office, the things we did, the things we failed to do. And also, I think other parties need to do that as well. But let me say this, you know, a lot of people believe that the health service can't be fixed. They think it doesn't matter who's in power. I don't agree with that. I think it can be fixed. There are lots of areas where we have seen real improvements in the last couple of years. But I absolutely get the fact that people are furious with us that we haven't reduced overcrowding in emergency departments. I hear that all the time. I understand that. And it's one of the things that if we're re-elected to office, we will continue to focus on, continue to put those extra beds into the hospitals and continue to invest in primary care and community care.
If you haven't done it by now, why should anyone believe that you will do it in the future if you're given another chance?
Because we have started that. You know, it's only in the last couple of years that we've been able to invest in our health service. Only 2 years since we balanced the books. And in that time, we have added hundreds of extra hospital beds. We have three hospitals under construction. We started to implement Sláinte Care, a new contract with nurses, changing the way they work, paying them better, a new contract with GPs, started the negotiations on a new contract with consultants. I would hate to see all of that fall asunder and for us to move backwards.
Okay, there was cross-party agreement on Sláinte Care. An awful lot of independent observers said it's an excellent plan to reform the health service, but yet it seems to be done at an extremely slow pace so far. He's even a member of your own party, Professor Anthony Staines up in Dublin City University. He has argued that you need to set aside a separate fund for the implementation of it on top of the $17 billion a year that's spent on health at present. Why don't you do that?
Well, see, I'm not sure what that entirely means, because if you look at the $17 billion, for example, that we set aside for health every year, a lot of that includes, for example, new beds, which is part of Sláinte Care. It includes expanding free GP care, which is part of Sláinte Care. It includes reducing prescription charges, you know, which is also part of Sláinte Care. And it also includes kind of structural reforms, for example, like setting up the regional health area. So all of these things that we're doing as part of that $17 billion are part of Sláinte Care. You could just put it in a different fund and call it something else, but I don't see
But it's
see
a
how
dedicated
that...
then restructuring fund with a specific achievement and aims for achievement.
Okay, so let's tease this out. Say you set up a dedicated fund for Sláinte Care, we'll say, a Sláinte Care fund, and you say there's 100 million euro for that every year. What would it be spent on?
It would be spent on the restructuring of getting various things out of the system, putting new things in place.
Let's
not disappear down
that
rabbit hole now.
I imagine if we did that, other people would accuse us of spin.
Okay.
You know, that we've set up this fund, but yet all the things the fund is doing is stuff that you would be doing anyway or you should be doing anyway.
Okay, I want to ask you about climate change because particularly for younger voters, this is a major, major issue. And there's a number of things that you have suggested you want to do in relation to climate change. Retrofitting, what is it? 500,000 houses in the country to make them more energy efficient. Who believes that will actually happen if we're having such difficulty in providing new houses and new apartments at present that somehow we'll find the people and the money to go and actually retrofit 500,000 houses?
Yeah, and that's you know, over the course of the decade. It's not in any one given year. And, you know, retrofit has really picked up in the last couple of years, and it works not just in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which is essential to stabilising our climate. It also means warmer homes. It means cleaner air. and it does create jobs all over the country. So it's something that we think is a good idea on a lot of different levels. But do bear in mind, when it comes to the new houses, we have changed the regulations around the new houses, and they're already built at a very high standard. They're near zero energy, near zero emission buildings. But if you're accusing me of being very ambitious in our climate targets,
I'm just wondering, are you realistic? Right. Because also, people, do you really believe that by the end of this decade we will have 1 million electric cars on our roads?
I think it's a very ambitious target, but we have to strive to do it. We've seen a big increase in the number of people who have hybrids and electric cars in recent years, coming from a very low base. But, you know, when it comes to climate change and climate action, I'd rather be accused of being overambitious and striving too high than being told that we're not being ambitious enough.
But is there not a danger that perhaps you're putting all the burden on individuals and on families rather than really dealing with the really big emitters and polluters, which are manufacturing, agriculture, that if you really want to do things, you should be investing in public transport and whatever, but not placing the burden of things like carbon taxes on individuals and families?
Well, if you're going to invest in public transport, you have to raise the funds to do so. But if you look at what we're doing, for example, renewable energy, we're now at about 30% of our electricity is being produced by renewables. And we're setting the target now to go to 70% by 2030. We're not putting any burden on individuals. That's very much government led. That's the kind of systemic system change that governments can make happen. For example, when it comes to transport, the investments that we have in Project Ireland 2040, like, for example, Metrolink, again, these are very much government-led, government-driven investments. And one of the things we said we would do is ring-fence the carbon tax for climate action. So using that to invest about 600 million in cycling facilities. So we're not of the view that somehow we can stop climate change solely by individual action. We do need individual action and communities acting and business acting. But it has to be led by government, because only government can actually change those systems. And even the carbon tax, which you mentioned, you know, many people may not be aware of this, but businesses pay, I think, 50-55% of the carbon tax. You know, it's related to the amount of carbon you produce.
But often they pass on the prices to customers.
And they would do that anyway, even if you put 100% of it on business.
Two things just to finish. We are running a bit over time, but in fairness, there's two things I want to finish out with. We mentioned briefly childcare. I think our childcare costs are three times the EU average. There are many people who are driving home now, or driving to collect their children from childcare, who find this almost like having a second mortgage. Why don't you do things like what Fianna Fáil is suggesting, put in a special tax credit for around €2,000 per child?
Well, childcare costs are really high. And, you know, it's my age group, my demographic, who really feel that. And for a lot of people, it is the equivalent of a month's mortgage or a month's rent. We've decided a different approach. That is improving preschool. Every kid now gets 2 years of full preschool, and we're going to, in our manifesto, provide extra weeks.
Will the childcare providers be able to provide? They're going on strike, taking a day out before the general election.
Well, they might do, but, you know, strikes can happen in any walk of life. You wouldn't give up on education.
They're saying they can't actually make money doing what they're required to do, and you're adding to their burden. A bit like how the doctors complain, you're adding to their burden.
No, they obviously will be paid for the additional preschool hours they're proposing. And we've also brought in the National Childcare Scheme, which subsidises childcare. You know, there are two ways in which you can help parents with the cost of childcare. One is a tax credit, the other is subsidies. The problem with tax credits is they tend to benefit those who pay the most tax most. So, for example, if you're a low-income parent or a low- to middle-income parent and you don't pay much tax, the tax credit isn't any good to you. So our system of expanding ECHE, of improving the National Childcare Scheme subsidies, is a lot fairer. And we're always being accused by Fianna Fáil of favouring the better off and not being fair. This is a perfect example where their criticism is not true, because working through the National Childcare Scheme and increasing the subsidies, making more people eligible for subsidies, and expanding ECHE, we're actually doing it in a much fairer way than Fianna Fáil's system, which would exclude people who don't pay tax.
I could spend the hour with you, but I know you don't have the time, and we're not going to get a chance to discuss crime, but I think we will be doing that with other party representatives in the weeks to come. But I do want to ask you about Brexit, because you seem to be putting an enormous emphasis on something that, as far as a lot of people are concerned, Brexit is being done at the end of the month. And the future negotiations are going to take place between the European Commission and the UK about the new trading relationships, mainly the competency of Phil Hogan. Does it matter who's in government in Ireland while that process is going on?
Yeah, of course it does. And, you know, the truth is Brexit isn't done. It's only half time. And what's essential now, and it's pretty urgent because we will decide on the negotiating guidelines at the European Council in March. Won't be decided by the European Commission, by the way, or by Phil Hogan. It'll be decided by the European Council, at which all of the prime ministers of the EU attend. We will decide on the negotiating guidelines for that treaty agreement. We'll be deciding on what the trade-offs are and what will be prioritised and what will not. And you're going to need somebody there fighting Ireland's corner to make sure that things like our fisheries are protected, to make sure that our beef sector and agriculture sector are protected. And it's the negotiating guidelines that are the marching
Surely
orders for
any
the Commission.
Government will do all those things in behalf of Ireland, whether you're in charge of it or not.
Yeah, but the question that people have to ask is, will they do it effectively? You have a team of me, Simon Coveney and Helen McEntee, who I think everyone at least says that we did a good job on Brexit in terms of what's been achieved so far. Or you can go to a team led by somebody like Micheál Martin, who when he last negotiated for Ireland, brought the Troika in. USC, FEMPI, income tax cuts, cuts to minimum wage. Do people really want to go back to that? I don't think they do.
We'll put that to Micheál Martin when he's sitting in that seat for his interview here on The Last Word on Today FM. Leader of Fine Gael Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.